Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 146. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a couple of movies that Michael Caine made around 1970. The first one is a World War II drama directed by Robert Aldrich, that is Too Late the Hero, which also stars Cliff Robertson and Denham Elliott. And then we go back to the 30-year war in the 17th century for a look at The Last Valley, also starring Omar Sharif and Nigel Davenport. Two very different films, but there are aspects to the films that relate to Michael Caine's previous life, and I'm going to go into that a little bit. So I'll get the contact details out of the way, and when I get back, we'll start talking movies. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hi, how's everybody doing? We're doing pretty fine here. The weather is warming up. I'm back at work after taking the time off to go up to Sydney for my sister's wedding. And everything's kind of, you know, just turning back into normal, which is, you know, it'd be nice if I could kind of tool around the countryside visiting people all the time, but I don't really have that as an option. So reality strikes back. Of course, I've got to do the obligatory mention of the Patreon campaign. If you go to patreon.com/paleocinema, you'll find the page there, and you can subscribe and donate towards the ongoing costs of the podcast. We're doing okay at the moment, but never hurts to get some more subscribers there. So what have I been watching? A few things, a lot of television, but as far as movies are concerned, I'll just get up the Letterboxd. Not a large amount, but I'll go through what I have watched. I did watch A Dirty Shame, the John Waters movie, starring Tracy Ullman and Johnny Knoxville. I always kind of liked the transgressive fun of a John Waters movie, the fact that he's just so gleefully perverted. And he kind of turns it into a weird, wholesome kind of thing at times. So I did enjoy that. I hadn't seen it before. So I kind of played with that and had a good time. It was actually on World Movies Channel on pay TV here in Australia, which is nice to see. I did a rewatch on Kick-Ass 2, which is not as good as the first one. But I just got it on Blu-ray, so I thought I'd give it a watch. Not too bad, not as good as it should have been, but and of course not quite as dark as the comic books. For the radio gig, I did a gig with Brendan Phelan, who's taken over from Liz while she's on vacation, and we decided to go for a bloke movie, so we did The Great Escape with Steve McQueen and all the other guys, Charles Bronson, James Coburn, Dickie Attenborough, and all of those guys, and had a really wide-ranging conversation. We actually ran out of time. We were just shooting the shit about movies in general. It was quite fun, and it was nice to kind of have a guy to talk to, even though it is good to have a talk to Liz. Just for a bit of a change, having a guy to talk to on the radio about movies was a bit of fun. I did see the Luc Besson movie, Lucy, as well. I may well do a Martian Drive-In podcast about that one at some stage in the future, starring Scarlett Johansson. Leaving aside that trope about us only using 10% of our brain, which is not true. It's a good visualized metaphor for what goes on as Lucy, the character, heads towards kind of transcendence. I kind of like it. I like the movie a lot. I like the clips that Besson used to illustrate his points. Sometimes they were kind of over-egging the pudding a little bit, but I kind of like the way he's used those to clarify what he's saying and to use and to say things visually rather than in words, which is kind of cool. If you haven't seen it, give it a go. It's much better than Under the Skin, I think, as far as Scarlett Johansson science fiction movies are concerned. And it really is a feast for the eyes. I did see another Johnny Knoxville movie for no good reason. I saw Bad Grandpa, which Sal liked a lot more than me because it had lots of kind of ball jokes and bum jokes and dick jokes and things like that in it. But that I won't say any more about that except for the fact that I saw it. I did see an Alasdair MacLean adaptation from 1971, Puppet on a Chain, starring Sven Bertel-Taube. And, that one's kind of good. There's a really terrific motorboat chase through Amsterdam, through the canals of Amsterdam, which kind of inspired the boat chases in Live and Let Die, the James Bond movie. It's not a bad action film. It's nice to see somebody who's not English or American as a protagonist in one of these kind of Euro crime sort of movies of the era. And it was a nice little watch. I stayed alert all the way through it and I was really paying attention. I liked what they did with it. What else have I seen? And I have also seen a Brian Trenchard Smith movie from last year, I think, called Drive Hard, starring Thomas Jane and John Cusack. Even though it was filmed in Queensland here in Australia, and even though Brian Trenchard Smith is an Australian director, wasn't in love with this one. Yeah, there were some nice car bits, but I'd seen nice car bits in other movies. And I think the script wasn't very good at all. Really, if you want to be a Brian Trenchard Smith completist, please see it. But it's not among his best work. But nonetheless, it's nice to see him continue his career. And the other thing I've watched, apart from the two movies that I've done for the podcast, and I'll tell you what they are in a moment, is I got a Blu-ray of Funny Face, the Stanley Donen movie starring Fred Astaire and also Audrey Hepburn, which I kind of enjoyed visually. It's a beautiful film. It's really got some lovely visuals, which were helped by Richard Avedon. And it's also got Kay Thompson in it, who's spectacular and steals several scenes in the movie. It's set in Paris, apart from New York City, and I always like a movie set in Paris, and the Paris visuals are quite interesting. And it's I may well see if we can do it for the radio gig, because I think Liz may like it. I'll give it a go anyway. I might throw that to her as a suggestion for the ABC Local Radio Northern Territory gig. But apart from that, I haven't really watched anything. I've been watching a lot of episodic TV, Arrow, Person of Interest, Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and stuff like that, and just watching those, plus my usual political shows on TV that I watch and tweet to, and all that kind of thing, but not too much else. There's a lot of things I've got in my pile of things to watch, which I'm really looking forward to watching, but I'll talk about them after I've watched them. So anyway, the two movies I'm going to do this time around are both by Michael Caine. And the first one is Too Late the Hero from 1970, which also stars Cliff Robertson, Denholm Elliott, and a cast of good British actors. It's kind of a World War II movie, a little bit unusual, and it's kind of got a lot of Vietnam parallels that is crammed in there by the director Robert Aldrich. So that was the first one. And the second one is a very difficult movie. This was recommended by Armin, our friend from Germany, who was on the podcast a while back. And that is The Last Valley. It was directed by James Clavell, the guy who wrote Shogun and Taipan and all those sort of things. Born in Sydney like I was. And it's set during the 30-year war in the 17th century. Stars Michael Caine, of course, Omar Sharif and Nigel Davenport. And I found it a really good film. Of the two, I think it's the one I liked the best, but I'll talk about them in a moment. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'll talk about Too Late the Hero, the World War II action film, action personality drama kind of film, which is pretty interesting in its own way.
So easy to love, so easy to idolize all others above, so worth the yearning for, so swell to keep every home fire burning for. We'd be so grand at the game, so carefree together that it does seem a shame that you can't see your future with me, 'cause you'd be oh, so easy to love. You'd be so easy to love, so easy to idolize all others above, so worth the yearning for, so swell to keep every home fire burning for. We'd be so grand at the game, so carefree together that it does seem a shame that you can't see your future with me, 'cause you'd be oh, so easy to love. You'd be oh, so easy to love. So easy to love.
That was Jerry Lewis's version of Easy to Love. I just thought I'd throw that in there because I found it. It's not too bad. It's got some good orchestration in the background, and he doesn't do a half bad job of it. So it's time to talk about Too Late the Hero, a 1970 Anglo-American war film directed by Robert Aldrich. Stars Michael Caine, Henry Fonda, Cliff Robertson, Ken Takakura, Denholm Elliott, Ian Bannon, Lance Percival, Ronald Fraser, Harry Andrews, and Percy Herbert. I'll give you a little bit of a brief idea about what it's about. There's a little bit of a grab of the briefing between Henry Fonda's character and Cliff Robertson's that I'm going to play in a moment. But basically, in 1942, World War II, Lieutenant Sam Lawson, U.S. Navy, Cliff Robertson, is a Japanese language interpreter. He's basically avoided combat wherever he could, and suddenly he's given a job to go to a British base in the New Hebrides for a mission. What they've got to do is destroy a Japanese radio transmitter to avoid them sounding the alarm regarding an American naval convoy, which is scheduled to appear in 3 days. The post radio operator transmits an all-well signal every night at midnight, and it'll be Lawson's job to transmit a fake signal in Japanese to buy the Allies another 24 hours. So basically, commando group led by Captain Hornsby, played by Denholm Elliott, have to go and take Cliff Robertson's character to the Japanese base, infiltrate it, get the signal sent. That's it. And then obviously come back. Now, Lawson's a lazy bugger. I'm going to play the grab now from Henry Fonda's briefing of him before he goes on to this, which pretty much everybody suggests once he gets to the base is a suicide mission.
Somebody said you were looking for me, is that right? Oh, by the way, how'd you make out with that funny broad at the club last night?
I was under the impression that the funny broad was with you.
Oh, hell, I brought her, but she liked you, John. She really liked you. That's why I left.
I wouldn't want to appear ungallant, but I think I'd just as soon do without your assistance in that direction.
Oh, that's nice. I thought I was doing you a favor. Anyway, what's all the panic? I was just getting ready to eat.
I have a job for you.
What, before I go on leave?
Yes, before you go on leave.
All right, as long as I'm on that midday plane tomorrow.
Very gracious of you, but it's going to take a little longer than that.
Can't, John. I got a 4 weeks leave coming.
Later.
Later, nothing. High noon tomorrow, I'm on that plane. I'm going to be in Frisco Sunday night.
We're flying you out of here this afternoon. You'll be in the New Hebrides Sunday night.
The New Hebrides.
I'm your orders here. You'll report to one of the British combat units on one of the islands. They need someone who can speak Japanese.
Combat unit, what's that? What the hell is that, John? First you talk about postpone my leave, now you're talking about combat? John, there are three other officers in the radio section, and two of them speak a lot better Japanese than me.
All three of them are a lot older than
me. Well, that's good. They're mature. But who picked on me?
I did, and it's not a question of picking on you. This is something the British are organizing for us. It's going to involve a certain amount of physical hardship. We have to supply the man. It's my opinion you're the man for the job.
No, no, John. Negative, negative. No, pick Aunt Nellie. He likes all that military crap. Not me, John. No.
I'm sending you, Lieutenant.
Lieutenant, I'm Sam, John. Don't you remember?
Sit down.
Oh, now, look, don't be...
Sit down, Lieutenant. I have to comply with an instruction from higher authority. A lot higher. In order to do that, I'm obliged to make do with the best possible personnel I have. I happen to think you're a long way from being right for the job, but you're the only one who can begin to meet the physical requirements. Fortunately, they don't appear to be concerned about much else. So get your things packed and report to the transportation officer in 25 minutes.
John, you mentioned a combat unit. I guess that means a bunch of limeys running around playing soldier getting shot at, right? Now, you may not remember this, or you may not be aware of it, but I volunteered for the service because as a language specialist, I was going to get a bar on my shoulder and be able to sit by a radio and eavesdrop on those fiendish Orientals. Now, if they're going to change those rules, I just might have to resign that commission.
That's your privilege.
And if I do, you'll have to send another officer. Right?
The order specifies Japanese-speaking personnel. If you'd like to resign your commission, the Navy'd be happy to accept it and send you out there as a seaman second class. Would you like me to arrange that for you right now?
Yes, sir.
I can't win, can I?
No, you can't. Incidentally, this operation is something the British are mounting for our benefit, so it wouldn't hurt to show them a little courtesy.
Courtesy?
That's right. Get along a lot better if you can manage not to call them limeys, that kind of thing.
I don't care if I get along with it or not.
Listen, you miserable bastard, I'm not interested in your problems. We lost two PT boats yesterday, not 2 miles from that bay down there. I have to spend the rest of this day writing to folks back in the States. Dear Mrs. Smith, the funny thing happened to your boy last night. He got burned up. What would you like me to tell him? Too bad your kid couldn't be a little bit smarter. Maybe he'd speak Japanese, so then we could have got him a job sitting on his ass. And then this mission come along, you know enough to say not me, but he doesn't look good. Go on, get out of here. I don't have time for you. Believe me, from what I hear about him, the British aren't going to need time for yourself. I hope they get your goddamn head shot off for you.
I'm sure we'll get along just fine, sir.
You're going to love him.
So that's it. And if that sounds a little bit familiar to you, it's exactly the same speech at the start of Edge of Tomorrow. Well, it's roughly the same speech at the start of Edge of Tomorrow between Brendan Gleeson and Tom Cruise in that movie. So they borrowed wholesale from Too Late the Hero for the start of a 2014 science fiction movie. So there you go. The more you know about movies, the more you can see where people steal things. So Lieutenant Lawson gets to the English base and finds it in a very unusual circumstance. The Japanese have got the top corner of the island, and the English base as a minefield between it and the rest of the island. Then the Japanese got a little bit clever and put their own minefield in between the English one. So basically, to get anywhere, the guys have to run through a minefield successfully without getting their asses shot off or blown up. And at the other end of it's a jungle where the Japanese can hide and pick off the soldiers. So the English have set up a whole bunch of mortars and heavy machine guns and things like that to hold the line there. But it still means that going through a minefield into a jungle under cover of mortar fire in order to get into the jungle and then capture a Japanese base pretty much is a non-trivial task. And the guys who are in the commando team basically are jobbing soldiers. They're not going to do more than they have to in their job. They're, in a sense, almost an equivalent of Lieutenant Lawson, but at a lower pay grade. Now, this parallels something in Michael Caine's own life. And this is why I found this really, really interesting. I've got a copy of the authorised biography from 1981 of Michael Caine called Raising Caine by William Hall, who was a friend of his. And Michael Caine actually wrote the foreword for it, so we'll have to take it with a grain of salt, but there does seem to be a certain level of honesty, particularly about his national service in 1951 and 1952. Now, the second year of his national service is the one that most parallels his role as Tosh, one of the soldiers in the commando team that go out to capture the Japanese base. In that, the second year of Michael Caine's national service, he took a ship to Busan in Korea and fought for a year in the Korean War. Not many people know this stuff, which is a joke, but I'll leave that go. So basically, Michael Caine was a frontline soldier in the Korean War, and even the stuff that came through the process of the authorized biography is pretty hair-raising. He did a number of patrols and a couple of times almost got himself killed in the year that he spent in Korea. It was really a hard and a nasty kind of infantryman's task of basically saving their side of things. And he wasn't wounded at all, but again, there was it was really tough. They spent a lot of their time moving ammo boxes and playing cards and doing things like that. But then they also went out on night patrols because the Chinese apparently were more likely to attack at nighttime. So that's when the patrols were really necessary and required. And it's a very scary 12 months that Michael Caine went through. He ended up kind of really brown, really, really, really fit, which helped him when he came back to England, was out of the service, and then restarted his career as an actor. He'd done a little bit before he left, but he started his career as an actor, and all the other actors in England at the time, particularly in repertory companies, which is where he started, were kind of weedy little lean gay guys, and suddenly they have a role that requires a great big strapping guy, and Caine's well over 6 foot tall. He was perfect for the role because he was suntanned and quite big. Unfortunately, he did get an incredibly nasty dose of malaria not long after his return. He had to spend 17 weeks in hospital with experimental treatments to cure it. But that's basically the National Service, and that time in Korea kicked off his career in some ways. So Michael Caine knew about being a kind of... He wasn't a particularly good soldier, by his own admission. It didn't take to authority well. There's a story that... And I'll read you this because it is hilariously funny, about when he was presented to General Eisenhower when they were training for National Service. This is directly from it. Let's see. Eisenhower's convoy sailed majestically down the line of bedraggled figures standing stiffly to attention, waist-deep in foxholes full of water. Lights blazing from the headlamps, white helmets gleaming. The general raised a hand as he passed by one figure and his jeep slewed to a stop in the mud. He looked down at Private Micklewhite's upper half. That's Michael Caine. The rest was submerged in muddy water. There was a recruiting drive on for the regular army and Ike was playing his part. "Well, soldier, tell me, how long have you been in the service?" he called down. 9 months, sir," responded Caine. "Are you thinking of signing on?" bellowed Ike encouragingly. "Signing on?" Caine's incredulous voice echoed down the line. "Am I fuck?" That's how he basically met Eisenhower, by swearing at him. Got in a lot of trouble for it, and it's actually the reason he went to Korea, because he was then in the shit big time, and they said to him, "Look, you can either do another 2 years of national service here in Germany," it was at the time he was in, "and or you can go to Korea for a year." And he took the Korea option, and he found out later on that the people who didn't take the Korea option were stuck in Germany for another year and then spent a year in Korea. So he kind of cut himself short on his national service by doing that. But, yeah, he was very ill-suited to the army life, let's put it that way. But he did do a year as a jobbing soldier in Korea. So he knew this character, Tosh, that he was playing inside and out. And Caine really does live it. He really does inhabit the character really well. And not by ever playing it or anything like that. It's a role that fits him like a second skin and really shows that he could play something else. And this is around the time when he was trying to get rid of the Cockney layabout roles, the Alfies and the Harry Palmers and those kind of working class roles. This is probably the last one of those kind of things he did before he went in a totally different direction with the other film I'm going to talk about, The Last Valley. Now, getting back to the director, Robert Aldrich, interesting director. I've talked about a few of his movies. I actually talked about a bunch of them in an early paleo cinema. He did Apache, Vera Cruz, Kiss Me Deadly, The Big Knife. I've talked about all of these films in Paleo Cinema Podcast. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane in 1962, Four for Texas. The Dirty Dozen, which is the one, the really big one before Too Late the Hero. And the people who made Too Late the Hero, the producers, really wanted a new Dirty Dozen. It didn't turn out that way, but that's what they were kind of shooting for, because The Dirty Dozen was an incredible financial success. In between Too Late the Hero and The Dirty Dozen, he did a few other films. The Legend of Lila Clare with Peter Finch and Kim Novak, which is a little bit schlocky. The Killing of Sister George, which is a lesbian melodrama in 1968. And Whatever Happened to Aunt Alice, he was a producer on. But he came as a director directly off the kind of London-based lesbian melodrama of The Killing of Sister George, straight into an incredible sausage fest of a war film in Too Late the Hero. He did a few other films after this that were really interesting. Ulzana's Raid, Emperor of the North, with Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine, which I'm going to have to talk about in a future podcast. I know a few other podcasts have covered it recently, so I really don't want to go at it too soon after they've had a go at it. He did Hustle, Twilight's Last Gleaming, The Choir Boys, The Frisco Kid, and All the Marbles with Peter Falk. So, Aldridge's, any of Aldridge's films are pretty much interesting. I don't have one that I can see here on the list I've got that I wouldn't watch again, which is a pretty good credit to him. Too Late the Hero was filmed actually in the Philippines during the Marcos regime, which is always an interesting time in the Philippines. And the guys were there for something like 6 months filming this movie. The temperatures were crazily hot. Everybody got the runs. The guys would work for a couple of weeks and then have 4 days off. Usually they'd fly out to Hong Kong or Tokyo or something like that for a little R&R, for kicking back for what's essentially a long weekend before they came back, knowing they'd have to go back into the jungle and do the job again. But, so it was a pretty hard production to make, and there's some really gritty bits in the movie. It isn't as gory or as visceral as a modern war film is, but for its time it was pretty hardcore. There's some nice bits of tension there. There's some friendly fire incidents. The leader of the commando group, played by Denholm Melia, basically is incompetent and nervous and is way, way out of his depth, which complicates the matter. And then Cliff Robertson's character, when things come to the crunch, basically fucks it up. He really doesn't do what he was sent there to do. And that then complicates things. And the survivors of the crew, after they do raid the Japanese base, have to work their way back through the Japanese soldiers to get back to their own base. And a propaganda war starts. Takakura Ken, the guy playing the leader of the Japanese soldiers, sets up speakers in the jungle and talks to these guys, basically does a Tokyo Rose on them, and harasses and harangues them all the way back to where the minefield is. And that really does wear away at the nerves of the surviving soldiers. Now, this is one of those ensemble casts of jobbing British actors who are really cool and really good at their job. Denholm Melia was always good at playing morally lost characters and that kind of edgy and nervous and incompetent, neurotic kind of characters, and he does it really well here. Ian Bannon's very good as a kind of nutter character that he plays in the group. Percy Herbert, who actually was a prisoner of war at one stage in World War II, and whose face you'll know really well if you don't know the name, is good as one of the soldiers as well. You've got Ronald Fraser, who turned up in any number of, he must have done 100 films in the 1960s and early 1970s. He turns up in there as well. So thematically, the movie's pretty much an anti-Vietnam film, even though it's set in World War II. The parallels are pretty explicit there. The guys don't want to be there. Their mission's kind of moot and a suicide mission. The people who send them there don't give a shit about them as people. And apart from Harry Andrews as the base commander at the English base, And there are a lot of kind of futility of war themes running through this one. But it still comes down to the acting, and the acting is superb. This ensemble does really well. I think Cliff Robertson is the weakest of the characters, which kind of is interesting because during World War II, Cliff Robertson was in the Merchant Marine. He was in the basically a sailor, but not a military sailor during World War II, where these other guys all had military training and experience in various wars to a large extent. And that kind of makes it interesting there too. Oddly enough, while they were filming this movie, Cliff Robertson won the Academy Award for Charlie, the movie I've spoken about in a previous podcast, and wasn't able to get back to accept the Academy Award at the time. I mean, he'd done a number of war films previously, PT-109, for instance, and a few other things, but I think that as much as his character was, it feels a little bit like Cliff Robertson, the actor, was a fish out of water with this otherwise very Anglo crew, and the only time he really shines and really is comfortable is in that scene with Henry Fonda, and the Henry Fonda thing is just pretty much that one scene. He comes in for a cameo almost to play the military commander who sends Lawson off to the English. But nonetheless, I mean, this isn't a particularly successful war film. It didn't make any money, and this is both of these films, in fact, the two Michael Caine films that I'm talking about this time, didn't really make much money, but they do show his skills as an actor. It probably suffers against a movie that he did in 1969 called Play Dirty, which is a lot more fun as an action film, so I'd recommend that one as well. But these two films, which he did back to back, Too Late the Hero and The Last Valley, really do I find interesting because of that proximity and because of the parallels they have to Michael Caine's earlier life. There's not too much else to say about this one. I recommend it. I don't say don't see it. Maybe do it in a double feature with Play Dirty and you'll see what I mean, because I like Play Dirty, and it's got a character actor in it that also appears in The Last Valley, being Nigel Davenport. And I kind of like that. If you go through Michael Caine's movie career in the 1960s, you see these same people turning up all the time, Harry Andrews and Nigel Davenport and people like that. These guys must have known each other pretty well by the time they were finished in the 1960s and had done a number of films together. But anyway, I'm going to take a break. Now I want to get back. We're going to talk about a very different film and a very atypical role for Michael Caine, being his role as the captain in the 1970/1971 historical drama, The Last Valley. I'll just leave you with a final audio clip from the movie, which is a scene where the British soldiers are basically gambling on which cockroach can run out of a circle quickest. And Ian Bannon's character squashes the cockroaches.
Hey! 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 Right! Hey! Keep those arms free! Keep those heads up! Get in step that man of the rear off! Keep your head in all the way! Get some more barrels off! Come on! Fire.
Okay, bookies off the course. No more bets. Ready?
Next, if you will, this one will be.
Go!
Hey, Connolly. Your bleed nose has been left at the post.
That's the way.
Hey, that's not fair. Hey, that's not fair.
Why not? My jockey's only using his whip, innit? If your bloke doesn't wake his bloody ideas up, you're going to owe me two packets of fags, Connolly.
He's right, Connolly. Even you can run faster than that pig.
All the same, it isn't fair.
Talk away and pet your nose, you money Mary.
But it isn't fair.
Stewart's inquiry.
Objection. Objection sustained. This bloody horse has been doped. What the bloody hell do you think you're flying at?
Don't argue with a steward, laddie. I've a mind to report you to the jockey club.
Even be tossed. I think his brains have come loose.
Yeah, well, you better watch it, Thornton. All right, let's have you. Come with me. Get those men, fellas. Right, Scott, right marker here. One straight line. Come on, come on.
Come on, come on.
Thornton.
Right, copper. Away on find Private Rogers. Curry, Rafferty, drive a riddle.
Okay, on to The Last Valley, directed by James Clavell. Wikipedia says 1970, IMDb says 1971. But I'm going to go with 1970, so I've got two movies by Michael Caine in this podcast that were done in 1970. It was based upon a novel called The Last Valley that was published in 1959 by J.B. Pick, and it was the last feature film photographed with the Todd AO 70mm widescreen process, which is kind of cool if you're a movie tech geek. The movie's really a bit of an odd one, and an odd one in the career of Michael Caine. He did state that he was fed up with paying Cockney larrikins and that kind of thing, and he wanted to do something way different than that. And this is very much that kind of movie. It starts out interesting with a character called Vogel, played by Omar Sharif. Yes, Omar Sharif, an Egyptian, is playing a German. Just roll with it. There's a very international cast in this one. And he basically is fleeing through the devastation that was the 30-year war between 1618 and 1648. 30-year war was a whole bunch of different things. It was a war between Protestants and Catholics. It was egged on by the Ottoman Empire in the east. It was also about there were a whole bunch of very small kind of kingdoms and principalities and palatinates and all sorts of other things all across Europe, and basically it turned into an enormous clusterfuck that stretched from the Ottoman Empire in the east all the way to the Netherlands in the west and lasted for, as the name suggests, 30 years. People were devastated. There was the sack of Magdeburg, where basically they started out with 30,000 people in a town, ended up with 5,000 people. The whole town was razed. It's actually mentioned in the movie, and it's a nasty piece of history from the last millennium. It really was a mean and nasty time. If you look at the Wikipedia page about the 30-year war, you'd be surprised at the devastation. They had plagues, which this movie does demonstrate. There were ethnic cleansings, as we now call them, and all sorts of atrocities. There were tortures, which the movie again does address. And it was just really not a good time to be in the area. So it starts out with Vogel basically begging a small farmstead to give him food in return for a piece of metal that he's got. Obviously, it's a precious metal, silver or gold neck piece. And they decline and they tell him, no, we're starving ourselves, we can't feed you. Now, they weren't actually starving because they did have a few cattle and a few chickens around. But they were used to being ravaged regularly. All of that area of Europe was. Armies would flow through there and just basically rape, kill and pillage wantonly all the way through it. So Vogel begs them, and as he's begging them, the troops of a man called the Captain come into the homestead and basically rape and pillage their way through it as Vogel escapes over quite a high hill. Vogel stumbles through a plague pit where the bodies of the dead are and ends up going through this nightmarish, ravaged landscape and seeing, in a quite ineffective scene, all of the devastation of the 30-year war until finally he stumbles down the hill into an untouched valley. The valley hasn't been touched by the war at all. The farmsteads look wealthy. The land is green and sunny and fertile. There are cattle and other livestock around. The crops are in the fields. He eats some grapes off a grapevine that's very productive there. And it's like he stumbled into a kind of heaven kind of place. As he does, the soldiers of the Captain, played by Michael Caine, also appear. And the people of the farmstead are away. They've obviously been pasturing their cattle on a different area, and they haven't come back to the town yet. And Vogel and the Captain have a confrontation. I'll just play that bit. It's a little bit long, but I think it does set up the movie effectively. And the character who disagrees with the Captain in this clip is played by Brian Blessed, wearing a faux hawk, which is kind of cool. A young Brian Blessed, great character actor, fantastic voice. It doesn't last long in the movie, but he is very effective in the little bit that he does have there. But I'll play that now, and then I'll get into why I find this a very effective and, at times, very touching movie.
Let us all, Captain, except this bastard.
Where are your friends? And where are your cattle? Wake him up.
I don't know. I came here alone this morning after food. I've never seen this valley before.
That won't do. Speak fast. I lost patience 12 years ago.
2 years are better than 40, Captain.
You can't bargain with me. I can crush you and your village like a bedbug.
That's what I want to talk to you about.
Break open every house. Get all we can use in that barn. Nothing in your own saddlebags. We'll round up the peasants and fire the village at leisure. Korsky, over there. You come with me.
I don't like secrets.
Well,
you can come too, Korsky.
Well?
There's famine all over Germany. Plague, pestilence, even now. And winter's coming. In 10, 20 years, have you seen a richer valley?
I don't answer questions.
Take their grain and cattle and they starve this winter.
I'm tiring of you. Come to your point.
I'm there now, Captain. Take all this food back to your army and down it goes into 1,000 stomachs. Why such waste? Winter here. Occupy the valley.
What?
Winter here. Live while your army dies. You'll never get another chance like this.
Is this scum asking us to desert? Is that it?
A soldier has no future and no past. And a full belly covers the present.
You talk too much. I'm not like peasant.
What are you?
A stinking priest.
I don't know which side you're on, Captain. But I'll wager half your men don't care.
What of those who do care? Huh?
Get rid of them.
Good ideas are rare these days. Very rare. You are a priest on the run?
No, I was a teacher.
What's your name?
Vogel. Yours?
Captain. Where are you from?
Oh, nowhere, everywhere, Captain.
Yes.
I have almost forgotten where I was born also.
You have fever?
No, it's nothing.
Didn't you say get rid of them?
Yes, but, well, it was so sudden.
And clean. One moment alive, one moment dead. You philosophers are such hypocrites.
I only do what is necessary. No more. If to kill is necessary, I do it. Without conscience. Now, make peace with whatever god you worship.
Of course, the captain doesn't kill Vogel. He decides to use him as a liaison between the villagers when they arrive and the soldiers. And they kind of come to a negotiation to enable the soldiers to winter in this valley. The valley, entrance to the valley gets blocked by snow over winter, kind of like in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. And they decide to settle in. An agreement's made for a number of things, food and lodging, of course. Six of the local women are volunteered, in inverted commas, as comfort women for the soldiers, and they kind of settle in. And the captain also finds a woman called Erica, played by Florinda Bulk, a Brazilian actress. Again, this is a very international cast, who is the consort of the man Gruber, who runs the village. And Gruber is played by Nigel Davenport. There's also another player in the political struggle and kind of social struggle in this movie, and that is the local Catholic priest played by Per Oscarsson, a Swedish actor who has had a very long career, and he plays the priest trying to keep control of the village and trying to manipulate things by his belief system. And that is one of the tensions that leads to quite an ugly ending to this film. Now, Michael Caine, as you heard, is doing a German accent there, and he's doing it quite well too. The other part of his national service, as I said earlier, was done. He'd spent a year in Germany as part of his national service, so he knew German accents quite well and knew German people, of course, from that year. He also made a funeral in Berlin, of course, and had spent time in Germany for various reasons. And he said that the most interesting thing about doing the German accent, apart from the fact that it did get him away from doing Cockney and English accents of various kinds for a while, and he was really wanted to break out of that pattern, was the way you approach it as an actor. And he said there's a good way of approaching it. You don't approach it as somebody doing a German accent. You approach it as a German person trying to speak grammatically correct English. And that was his approach on doing that. And I think it's very effective too. There's not a trace of Alfie or Harry Palmer or even Tosh from Too Late the Hero in the manner or the vocal ticks that Michael Caine's Captain, and he only is ever called the Captain, brings to this movie. And he's really effective in the film. He's upright. You can tell he's a military man. He's got that upright stance. He's thinks for himself. He spent his whole life in war, he said. He was born to a camp follower, and basically his whole life has been in military campaigns, and so there's nothing. It's a little bit like Qualo Cabrigni in Soldier, the Twilight Zone episode that Harlan Ellison wrote that I talked about in the last Martian Drive-In podcast. There's nothing about this guy that isn't a soldier, as is amply demonstrated by that little clip that I played there. So the captain settles in with his men. There are various problems. Some of the men are Protestant, some of them are Catholic. The Protestant ones want to tear down the Catholic church in the valley, but they decide that rather than do that, the Protestants will build their own kind of shrine or their own church. There's also a problem with a shrine to the Virgin Mary, which is on the entrance to the valley, and maybe a bit of an indicator to other people coming in that the valley exists and that the valley is inhabited. And so the captain decides to move that shrine to the Virgin Mary to another location. That causes a certain tension with the villagers as well, even though it's in their best interest to lay low while all of this 30-year war is ravaging Europe. The captain also has a lot of interactions with Gruber, including the fact that Gruber decides he's going to roll dice with the captain for the affections of Erica. And that's kind of played at the first level. You think it's being played as men having control over women. But in a weird way, Erica takes control and makes her decision for herself on which man she wants to go with. Of course, it is a captain. But there's a nice little subtlety to the way that that's done, and a political edge to the way it's done. And the captain does start a relationship with Erica, who's a very unconventional person in the village. For a start, she can't have children, and that is an indication in the worldview of the time that she may be a witch. She also tries to cast a couple of spells, which the captain finds out about, which the captain doesn't particularly mind because he himself is an atheist. He doesn't believe any of the crap that religion sells. He doesn't believe any of the things that are going on. He's fighting because he's a soldier. He's not fighting for any ideological purpose. It's all he knows and pretty much all he perceives that he can do. And so he has to be that. But his vision of what's going on in Europe is not clouded by ideology. He clearly sees there's about a whole bunch of little princes and power brokers and church people and popes and things like that that are basically trying to run things, and all of it's caused by that. But in spite of that, he is a soldier, and that is his duty to fulfill, even though he is taking this season off in the valley. And that's kind of interesting too. There are other people in the village as well, a number of women there. There's a really weird bit of casting with Arthur O'Connell, an American actor, playing one of the villagers. Now, Arthur O'Connell, I've looked through his IMDb. Everything he did for a while before and after this movie was TV stuff in America. And then suddenly he's in Europe doing this movie, which is kind of an odd bit of casting. I don't know whether his voice is dubbed. It's a little hard to tell whether it's dubbed or whether he actually does the accent. But he does play one of the villagers, and he's the only American in the movie, which is makes it a little bit odd. There are a whole bunch of other English actors in there, English character actors, including, as I said, Brian Blessed. But as the movie progresses and the townspeople and the soldiers make their accommodations, you get the sense of the politics of the time and the way both Gruber, the captain, and Vogel as an intermediary use politics to ensure the peace in the village. Now, of course, the local priest is the wild card there. The local priest has got his own agenda, which is not amenable to rationalism, even though Gruber, to an extent, Vogel very much so, and the captain are more or less rationalist characters. They base their decisions on evidence and what they believe is right for the village without any supernatural underpinnings. So eventually the spring thaw comes and the captain and a trader comes through into the village, played by Vladek Shabal, great character actor in a lot of spy movies. He played Kronstein, for instance, in From Russia with Love. Comes in and updates them on what's going on in the area and gives the captain information which leads him to decide that he must go back and support his side in an important battle at a river crossing. And so the captain leaves a few of his soldiers behind with Vogel and decides that he needs to go and fight this battle because it's his duty to do so. He takes most of his men with him. And there are only about 17 to 20 of them. And they head off to fight this battle. And that's where things start deteriorating from there. And eventually the captain does come back to the valley for the ending of the film. So basically this movie is really interesting for a number of reasons. It's very much a rationalist film. It's one that Michael Caine wanted to make it for that reason as well. He doesn't believe in God, and he's pretty much an avowed atheist himself. And this was a man in a very kind of religiously dominated time who is a soldier but who doesn't believe any of the supernatural stuff and needs to negotiate his way through that in order to attain the goals that he sets himself. And that makes it interesting. Vogel's very much a weaker character. I don't think it's among Omar Sharif's better roles. I think it's among Michael Caine's best roles of this era, very much so, playing the captain. But Vogel is, I don't know whether it was underwritten or whether there's just not, I don't know whether Omar Sharif gave it his A game or anything like that, but he's playing against type as well. Omar Sharif usually plays much larger characters than Vogel. But let me know what you think about that, because I think either the role's very underwritten or Sharif really didn't try very hard in this one. But he's among the weakest of the characters. Nigel Davenport's very good playing Gruber. He doesn't have a lot of scenes, but he has a few really good ones. And Florinda Balkan's very beautiful, but not particularly a gifted actor, I don't think, playing Erica. But there are some scenes between her and Michael Caine which are really touching and poignant, and really do illustrate in a very effective way both the character and the changing character of the captain and Erica's character and how her life has been and the path that she's got to walk in things. Now, the movie ends on a very down note. I'm not going to do a spoiler on it because I think it's important that people find that out for themselves. But I think it's really effective. It was filmed in the Tyrol in Austria. And you can actually go and stay in the particular valley where it was filmed, which is kind of cool. And it looks very similar, but with more modern hotels. I've done a bit of a web search on the place. It was in a place called Trins in the Tyrol in Austria. And in the, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Armin, I'll warn you up front, Geschnitzel Valley there. And it's a really, I do find it an interesting film. I think that James Clavell's direction, he didn't direct a lot of things. You can have a look at his IMDb. He's directed a few things, but not a lot. I think it's a very effective direction. I think that John Barry's music for the movie is very understated for John Barry. and effective, even though he does use some instruments and orchestrations similar to some of the stuff he's done for the James Bond films. They kind of slightly remind you of James Bond movie music from the 1960s and can take you out of it. I think that overall it's a very effective score. And I really do like this film. I think I like actors, as I've said before, I like actors who get out of their comfort zone and try new things. And this is very much a case of Michael Caine doing that. He's playing a character very unlike any that he's played before, even very different from Bromhead, the soldier he played in Zulu. He's playing a man from another time. And there's a precision to the acting that he does, which I find really, really admirable and really, really kind of mesmerizing as well. There's not too much else I want to say about this movie because I'd go into spoilers if I did. But I think that the period feel is really good. I think that the locations are beautiful and fantastic. And I think that really there's some things this movie says that can be considered contemporary themes as well. Religious fanaticism as a political force, the idea of war and what that does to men, that's another part of it as well. And also the humanizing and civilizing effect of women on men. I think that's another thing that comes through this movie in a lot of ways. But thank you, Armour, for reminding me of this film. I really do appreciate it, mate. And I think that I'm really going to have to try to find a legitimate copy of it. I think it's one I definitely want to pay money for rather than skimming and scamming, as I sometimes do for these films. I think it really is an effective movie for that reason. I think it's worthy of that consideration. There are a whole bunch of other Michael Caine movies. I've looked through a lot of his stuff and I read the biography again that I really want to touch on in future podcasts. So this doing this little exercise in 1970 Michael Caine movies has led me on to other things, and they've all gone onto the list. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, there is a little bit of feedback, and I'll plonk that in, and we'll tie the loose ends up and finish the podcast.
We kiss in a shadow. We hide from the moon. Our meetings are few and over too soon. We speak in a whisper, afraid to be heard. When people are near, we speak not a word. Alone in our secret, together we sigh for one smiling day to be free. To kiss in the sunlight and say to the sky, behold and believe what you see. Behold how my lover loves me. To kiss in the sunlight, say to the sky, behold and believe what you see. Behold how my lover loves me.
That was We Kiss in a Shadow from South Pacific by Adam Wade. Yes, we did get feedback. Hooray, got feedback. Yay. From Morris from Love That Album. who just hangs out across town from me most of the time. Morris says, "Hey, Terry, thought I'd drop you a note. I listened to episode 145 of Paleo Cinema and thoroughly enjoyed it. To this day, I haven't seen The 12 Chairs, and I'm not sure why. It's been available at the video library. Yep, I'm still using that as my primary source for films, and I'm a Brooks fan. My father sat through the producers about 200 times, much to my mother's chagrin, which means I must have sat through it 50 times or so watching it with him. I pretty much enjoyed everything up to and including Spaceballs, so I don't know why 12 Chairs is a gap in my Brooks film experience. Your review certainly sold me. What definitely won me over was your discussion of The Intruder. I'd never heard of it, but as you said, it was on YouTube, so I followed up on it. I was so drawn into this superb film. When you mentioned Charles Beaumont as the writer, and if I recall correctly, he played the school principal in the film as well, I was definitely interested. I love the episodes he wrote for Twilight Zone, like Static and Dead Man's Shoes. As an aside, now that you've covered some Outer Limits on MDIB, you should give Twilight Zone equal time. The film even looked like an episode of Twilight Zone, both in terms of the visual style and the dramatic build-up. Anyway, the story was completely riveting. Bill Shatner was certainly giving his A-game here. Charming, cowardly, rabble-rouser. He did all of this, and his character was completely believable. From a 21st century perspective, it's frightening to think that a town could behave the way they did and that they could allow themselves to be manipulated by Shatner's character. I agree with you that it was interesting that the character Tom McDaniel found his own arc to make the stand against segregation, and he wasn't just against it from the start of the film. It was probably a realistic scenario where people of the day who'd had horrible indoctrinations had to work to evict those philosophies by which they were raised. Anyway, thanks for bringing this film to the podcast. I was so rapt to have seen it, and it will be on my year's end top five first-time watches for me for sure. This film may be over 50 years old, but its presentation and unfortunately its content have not dated. Cheers, Morris, your musical director. And he sends a link to his a cappella group, The Ice Halos, which is www.icehalos.com. And also Love That Album podcast is at lovethatalbum.blogspot.com. Yeah, thanks for that, Morris. The Intruder I hadn't seen myself before, and I kind of grooved on it, and I really did enjoy it. It surprised me how good Shatner was. And that really is an interesting thing. I think that Star Trek was really good for Shatner in a lot of ways, but it was really bad for Shatner in other ways. It really did prevent him in some ways from continuing an effectively started dramatic career as a dramatic actor, and now he's become a kind of feature of popular culture, and that's where he is. I mean, it's made him a very wealthy man, there's no way two ways about it, but the Shatner in The Intruder is an interesting person whose career arc I would like to have seen without Star Trek in it, if you know what I mean. But yeah, thanks again for that feedback. And yeah, 12 Chairs is probably the least known of Brooks's films, with apart from maybe something like Life Stinks or even Silent Movie. But while it's not a perfect film, I do like it, and I like the fact that Brooks did something a bit different there, that rather than keeping an American-based movie. But yeah, thanks for that, Morris, and thanks for your feedback and support, of course, mate. So that's about it this time around. I'll leave you with a quote, which is really kind of interesting, and I found this quote while I was doing a little bit of research. It's from John Waters, of course, the Schlockmeister filmmaker. He said, "A movie star is someone you want to either get drunk with or have sex with." And that's pretty much it. Your favourite movie star, at least. So here's the question for the podcast. I want, first off, the movie star that you'd like to have a drink with most. And there's going to be a lot of Oliver Reed in this, I realise. And the one you'd like to have sex with if you were not otherwise entangled and that they were willing to do so. So basically, who would you like to get drunk with and who would you like to fuck? They're the two questions for this podcast. So send your answers to cultguru@gmail.com or put them onto the Paleo Cinema Cafe at Facebook. Either way is fine. Or even send an MP3 voicemail. Always happy to get those as well. So that's about it for this podcast. I'm going to leave you with the credits as usual. And then I'm going to leave you with a weird little track I found. It runs about 5 minutes, so you can stop it whenever you get bored with it. but it's a bit of African rap that I found, which is really kind of weird. I can only say weird. So anyway, look after yourselves. Take care. I'll be back next week with a Martian Drive-In podcast and back in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast. And keep watching good movies. And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his.
She will cut your balls off, my chief girlfriend. You cheat on her, you lie to her, you play around, you fuck around, you kick her face in. She will cut your balls off. Wait till you sleep. She will cut your balls off. Cut your balls off. She will cut your balls off. You lie to her, you cheat on her, you play around, you fuck around. She will cut your balls off. Cut your balls off. She will cut your wee-wee off. You fool around, you kiss around, you mess around, you kick her face in. She will cut your balls off. Wait till you sleep. She will cut your balls off. Cut your balls off. She will cut your balls off. You cheat on her, you lie to her, you play around, you fuck around, you kick her face in. She will cut your balls off. Wait till you sleep. She will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your dung off. She will cut your wee-wee off. You cheat on her, you lie to her, you play around, you fuck around, you kick her face in. She will cut your balls off. Wait till you sleep. She will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your dung off. She will cut your wee-wee off. You fool around, you kiss around, you mess around, you kick her face in. She will cut your balls off. Wait till you sleep. She will cut your balls off. She will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your dung off. She will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your wee-wee off. She will cut your dung off. Wait till you sleep. She will cut your balls off. Cut your dung off. She will cut your wee-wee off. Around, you kiss around, you mess around, you kick her face in. Wait till you sleep. She will cut your dung off. Cut your balls off. She will cut your wee-wee off. You fool around, you kiss around, you mess around, you kick her face in. She will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your wee-wee off. She will cut your dung off. Wait till you sleep. She will cut your dung off. Cut your wee-wee off. She will cut your balls off. Cut your balls off. She will cut your dung off. You cheat on her. You lie to her. You play around. You fool around. You kiss around. You kick her face in. She will cut your balls off. Wait till you sleep. She will cut your balls off. Cut your balls off. She will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your dung off. She will cut your balls off. You fool around, you kiss around, you mess around, you kick her face in. Wait till you sleep, she will cut your wee-wee off. Wear double panties. Wear double panties. Wear double panties. Wear double panties, she will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your wee-wee off, she will cut your dung off. Wait till you sleep, she will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your wee-wee off, she will cut your balls off. Cut your balls off, she will cut your balls off. Cut your wee-wee off, she will cut your balls off. Cut your balls off, she will cut your wee-wee off. You cheat on her, you lie to her, you play around, you fuck around, you kick her face in. She will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your balls off, she will cut your balls off. You fool around, you kiss around, you mess around, you kiss her face in. She will cut your balls off. Cut your wee-wee off, she will cut your wee-wee off. Cut your wee-wee off, she will cut your dung off. Cut your balls off, she will cut your balls off.